Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for April 29th, 2024. Here's today's rundown. Do the providers in your organization conduct peer-to-peer discussions? If so, are they valuable? Do you know for sure? Reporting our lead story today, physician and attorney Dr. John Cale Hall will explain how to measure the effectiveness of peer-to-peer interactions. We will also hear from Matthew Albright, healthcare attorneys Nicole Emanuel and David Glazer, plus Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. On Friday, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued a final rule. The final rule is designed to beef up protections against discrimination in healthcare based on race, color, national origin, sex, and disability. The final rule also expands physical and digital accessibility. We have a great deal of news to report, so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday Rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Last week, I talked about the lack of adoption of the new evaluation and management coding rules by physicians and urged all of you to get out there and make some noise at your hospitals to get it done. Well, two Rack Monitor e-news readers, coding expert Betsy Nicoletti and Dr. Robert Ubra, the doctor of documentation, pointed out that it's not quite as simple as it seems. They astutely pointed out that many hospitals have provisions in their medical staff rules that outline the required elements in a history and physical examination. Hospitals added these provisions years ago in response to accreditation surveys who would come into the OR, pull a random chart, and cite the hospital because the ophthalmologist doing a cataract extraction did not document that the patient was asked about the number of times they wake up to urinate. So before you tell your doctors to stop documenting the review of systems that they did not ask, ask your medical staff to check and work to get the medical staff rules changed. Now, in other news, CMS released a flurry of rules last week. As you heard from Chuck, one was about privacy. But another rule addressed nursing homes and will set specific staffing ratios for nursing. The rule mandates a total nurse staffing standard of 3.48 hours per resident per day, including at least 0.55 hours of care per resident by registered nurses, 2.45 hours per resident per day by nursing aides, and a requirement to have at least one registered nurse on site 24 hours a day. There are also reporting requirements and some flexibilities for rural areas. Now, this rule received almost 40,000 comments. That's a crazy number of comments. By contrast, CMS 4201F, our new favorite rule that requires MA plans to follow the two-midnight rule, received less than 1,000 comments. I certainly hope that CMS was able to ask ChatGPT to read all the comments and provide a summary for them. I suspect we all support CMS's intent here to improve the care of nursing home residents. And more nursing care certainly will lead to better care. But my hope is these requirements do not lead to some owners to determine the requirements are just too onerous or too expensive, especially with all the staffing shortages that we're seeing, and they may start closing facilities. That's certainly not an outcome that anyone would want. CMS also released two rules related to Medicaid and managed Medicaid, totaling about 2,000 pages. To try and standardize care and access in both traditional and managed Medicaid to ensure health equity, and once again, to try and assess payment adequacy. While I admit I only reviewed these three rules superficially, the most interesting thing I found in all of these rules was a section describing severability of the provisions, stating, quote, if any provision is held to be invalid or unenforceable, the remaining provisions, which could function independently, should take effect and be the maximal effect permitted by law. Now, Nicole and David and John Hall keep talking about a case at the Supreme Court that has something to do with Chevron and new regulations. I don't get it, but I wonder if this addition to the new rules is intended to prevent one provision to be found not to meet the standard, and that would then kill the whole rule. I'll gladly leave this discussion to our lawyers. Thanks, Chuck. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch was making his Monday rounds on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Money Rack Report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning. Hello, and happy Rack Monitor Monday. Today, I want to discuss a pressing issue that strikes middle-sized and small providers: the impact of CMS Medicare and Medicaid provider audits. Regardless whether it's a RAC or a MAC or a TPE or a UPIC or prepayment review, these on healthcare providers, these audits potentially can put healthcare providers out of business, A, prematurely, B, without due process, C, needlessly, and D, when the provider has committed no fraud, and E, further limiting access to care. I believe that most of our listeners represent sizable hospitals or hospital systems. An audit, while annoying, doesn't threaten the closure of the business. Other listeners may represent a facility or a string of facilities. An audit to a smaller entity is a formidable adversary financially and emotionally. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, conducts audits and prepayment reviews to ensure the integrity of the Medicare and Medicaid programs. While the goal is noble to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, the repercussions of these audits can be devastating for providers, especially smaller practices and clinics. The audit process itself is often lengthy, arduous, and resource intensive, diverting valuable time and attention away from patient care. In fact, I can name at least 20 facilities that I know of that were forced to close their doors because of the findings of a post-payment review, prepayment review, or a credible allegation of fraud. If you recall my segment from a couple weeks ago, recently I was successful in appealing a suspension based on credible allegations of fraud, or 42 CFR 455-23. The suspension was lifted and the facility was able to serve the consumers again. Now, generally, every audit will reveal irregularities in billing practices or documentation errors. It's like they say, stare at anything long enough and you will find fault. Suddenly, the facility or a clinic is thrust into a whirlwind of financial uncertainty, fines and repayment demands, and even exclusion from Medicare and Medicaid programs loom overhead like a dark cloud. But perhaps the most insidious aspect of these audits is the prepayment review. And I know you have heard me talk about this in the past, how draconian the prepayment review is. Under this process, CMS may withhold payment for claims until they are thoroughly reviewed and deemed appropriate. For providers already operating on thin margins, this delay in reimbursement can be crippling, jeopardizing their ability to cover operating costs, pay staff salaries, and keep the lights on. Sadly, for some providers, the consequences are dire. Unable to weather the financial storm unleashed by these audits, they are forced to close their doors for good. Patients lose access to vital healthcare services. Communities are left reeling from the void, and dedicated healthcare professionals find themselves out of work. This is a harsh reality faced by many providers across the country. And while we must remain vigilant in safeguarding taxpayer dollars and ensuring the integrity of our healthcare program, we must also recognize the human cost of these audits. Maybe as we move forward, we could lobby for a more balanced approach, one that holds providers accountable without unduly burdening them, one that promotes transparency and collaboration rather than fear and uncertainty. Medicare and Medicaid regulations, low reimbursement rates, and fear of audits impede access to care because providers refuse to accept Medicare and Medicaid. For example, in North Carolina, there are 200 oral surgeons. 9 accept Medicaid. 9. What is that, 5%? Medicaid patients also have a lengthy wait period before being seen. So I do think we need to relook and lobby for a better audit process. Back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Nicole. That was Healthcare Attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up in about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from Healthcare Attorney David Glazer, plus physician and advisor Dr. John K. Hall. He's standing by to report our lead story. It's Monday. It's April the 29th, and you're listening to the live edition of Monitor Monday. Stand by.
The American College of Physician Advisors is the only physician-led nonprofit national association of thought leaders representing all aspects of the physician advisor role. Developed to expand the influence of physician advisors through education and industry networking, the membership consists of physician advisors and other hospital leaders focused on a broad range of topics, including utilization management, case management, clinical documentation integrity, regulatory compliance, revenue cycle, and executive leadership. You're invited to partner with physician leaders and associated healthcare professionals and join in the efforts to foster greater physician executive influence within healthcare systems. Click on the ad on the RAC Monitor homepage or go to acpadvisors.org to learn more.
Here now with the Monitor Monday Risky Business Report is Healthcare Attorney David Glazer. David, as I say every Monday morning about the same time, what could be risky today?
Well, Chuck, it's the risk that the dull roar of Lake Superior will drown me out. But it's really the risk that you will be confused by the FTC's ruling last week. Well, I should say really its rule, banning some non-competes. There's a lot to unpack. There are already legal challenges to the rule. So while I know predicting the future is difficult and risky, and maybe that's the real risk for this segment is predicting the future, I would say that at least in the healthcare context, the probability that the challenge results in at least a temporary suspension of the rule seems very, very high. But what does the rule do? First, it's important to understand that the FTC has limited jurisdiction. In particular, it has oversight only over a corporation that is organized to carry on business for its own profit or that of its members. So courts and even the FTC have taken the position that nonprofits are generally outside the scope of the FTC's authority. That would mean for-profit entities like most physician clinics and some large hospital systems like Tenet would be covered by the rule and could not impose non-competes on employees, except in very limited situations. But nonprofit hospitals and clinics would be permitted to impose a non-compete unless some other law, like a state law, prohibited this. Now, this is a very weird result, and it's one reason I think courts are likely to intervene. The FTC recognizes the inconsistency, but when presenting the rule, it asserted that some entities that claim nonprofit status may, in fact, effectively be for-profit. It cites cases where courts have ruled that if a nonprofit has, quote, ceded effective control to a for-profit partner, the entity can lose its tax-exempt status. Now, that is certainly true, but it's also exceedingly rare. It would be revolutionary for the government to assert that most, or even many, nonprofits don't actually qualify for that status. According to the FTC, 58% of hospitals claim tax-exempt status, with another 19% being state or local-run organizations that are also outside the FTC's reach. In other words, the FTC admits that absent extenuating circumstances, 77% of hospitals are outside the scope of the new rule. Now, there are certainly some people who would like to eliminate tax-exempt status for hospitals, but that's a separate policy question well outside the scope of this non-compete discussion. Courts are likely to be troubled by a rule that only applies limitations to about a quarter of an industry. For individuals employed by a nonprofit or a government-run facility, this rule has no impact. For those employed by a for-profit organization, whether it's a hospital or a clinic, if the rule takes effect 120 days after it's published in the Federal Register, as it will, absent court intervention, in many cases, your non-compete would be invalid. The regulation will prohibit enforcement of any current non-compete if you are a non-executive employee, with the exception of non-competes associated with the sale of a business. Now, I might have had too many negatives in there, but it allows employers to continue to enforce a non-compete that's already in place with a senior executive. The rule defines senior executives as workers who are in a policymaking position and earn more than $151,164 a year. Very specific. It is likely, particularly in the physician-owned clinic world, that there are a number of employees who will have enough policy influence to be considered senior executives. That said, I still think the odds that this rule is going to take effect in healthcare are very low. A court injunction is, you know, could delay the rule. Now, even if a court prevents this rule from taking effect, it's part of a trend against non-competes. The FTC notes that there are provisions in Colorado, Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, New Mexico, South Dakota, Texas, and the District of Columbia that limit non-competes specifically for some healthcare professionals. And that list ignores broader non-compete limitations that exist in places like California, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and North Dakota that have broad restrictions on non-competes in all industries. Now, personally, I discourage my clients from imposing non-competes because I think they often cause litigation, as departing employees need to drum up a reason to void their non-compete. Whatever happens to the rule, the number of non-competes is likely to continue to fall. So, Chuck, like the FTC, I wouldn't mind a ban on non-competes, but I think that we will both be singing the Rolling Stones classic,
"You can't always get what you want."
You can't always get what you want. We will see if my thoughts cause me to get my fair share of abuse. Back to you.
Thanks, David, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Fredrickson & Byron in downtown Minneapolis. And up next, the Monitor Money Legislative Update with Matthew Albright.
The Legislative Update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Matthew Albright.
This week, the insurer Kaiser Permanente notified over 13 million of its members that their search information had been inadvertently transmitted to Google, also the app formerly known as Twitter, and other platforms. Also this week, the hospital system City of Hope told its patients that someone had accessed their personal information. And the industry, of course, is still sifting through the repercussions of the cyber attacks on Change Healthcare in February. In light of all these recent incidents, it's worth taking a look at what government cybersecurity rules are currently in place with regard to cybersecurity at the state and federal levels, and also what legislation we can expect in the near future. First, as many of us know, there is existing legislation around cybersecurity, but these requirements tend to focus on reactive measures that must be taken after a cyber attack or a breach. A prime example of this is guidance offered by HHS's Office of Civil Rights, or OCR. That guidance is titled, "My Entity Just Experienced a Cyber Attack. What Do I Do Now?" OCR is charged with enforcing the HIPAA security rule, written a quarter of a century ago, and the rules are relatively simple. All healthcare organizations should, first, have a plan in place in case they are attacked. Second, if they are attacked, they should do what they can to stop the incident and its consequences. If that sounds a little like common sense, it is. Finally, any organization faced with a security incident needs to tell the government and anyone affected by the incident. One example of a recent, more proactive requirement is that organizations are also required to tell the government if they see any indications of cyber threats. Sticking to the requirements that currently exist, all 50 states also have security rules, which again focus mostly on when and how an organization that suffers a security incident should tell the government and anyone affected by the incident. As many of you are aware, healthcare is far and away the most cyber-attacked industry in the country, with 249 attacks in 2023. Ransomware attacks against hospitals nearly doubled from 2022 to 2023. Given this incredible uptick in cyber attacks on healthcare, is there any new legislation on the horizon? Certainly for DC, the answer is not this year. In the immediate aftermath of the Change Healthcare attack, the administration itself has focused mostly on the impact to providers. For example, the administration offered advanced payments through Medicare and Medicaid. And a cybersecurity bill was introduced in Congress, and a hearing was held. The bill included proposed mandates on organizations with regard to best practices in defense of cybersecurity. However, lest we forget, this is an election year. Based on past election year experience, not very much legislation is expected to pass, and this Congress looks like it will align perfectly with that historical experience. Certainly, there is even less bipartisan kumbaya than normal in other election years, but also there is less time to get work done in any election year. Basically, everything that's going to get done in Congress has to be done before the end of July. So this year, we can expect continued hearings, maybe, and some rhetoric from Congress and likely amped up enforcement of existing law for the administration, but nothing substantive in terms of cybersecurity requirements. At the state level, it's a little different. In 2024, many states have actually introduced cybersecurity laws. However, these bills are not so much focused on healthcare cyber attack and breaches, but rather on election security, security of state agencies, and security standards in state contracting, and the emerging privacy issues related to porn and artificial intelligence-generated material. And of course, there's the issue of TikTok. So, Chuck, we really have yet to see any direct legislation, any direct legislative reaction to the increasing attacks on hospitals and healthcare systems. Instead, I'll leave you with the most quoted statement in DC these days. Let's just wait until after the election. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Matthew, very much. That was Matthew Albright. Matthew is the Chief Legislative Affairs Analyst for Zealous.
These days, everyone seems to be talking about artificial intelligence. AI is everywhere. AI in healthcare is worrisome, and few people are talking about it in the revenue cycle. Until now. Now there's an exclusive webcast on the topic. Senior healthcare consultant Michelle Wasorek addresses critical issues, such as the validation of AI algorithms and the importance of human validation in machine learning. The webcast, Navigating AI and Healthcare Revenue Cycle, Maximizing Efficiency, Minimizing Risks, is May 21st at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn about compliance risks and the potential for errors and audits, and how to remain compliant. The webcast, Navigating AI and Healthcare Revenue Cycle, Maximizing Efficiency, Minimizing Risks, is May 21st at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register now at the RAC University Bookstore for Navigating AI and Healthcare Revenue Cycle, Maximizing Efficiency, Minimizing Risks.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, we're monitoring the effectiveness of peer-to-peer discussions. So here now to report our lead story is Dr. John K. Hall. Dr. Hall, how effective are those interactions?
Well, it depends on how you measure those, Chuck. So I'm going to offer up some controversial thoughts. I'm going to talk about peer-to-peer discussions with payers, and I'll start with some experiences shared by RevCycle colleagues. First, probably a common situation, a colleague noted that a physician successfully overturned a denial on a zero midnight stay. The zero midnight stay, though, was due to a transfer for which the final coded DRG was a shared DRG. The transferring hospital got significantly less than an observation payment. They have no AB rebilling option since, thanks to the successful peer-to-peer, the claim is no longer denied. Another colleague shared a successful peer-to-peer overturn. At the time of the peer-to-peer, no one had recognized that the claim was a readmission. Subsequently, the hospital received the denial for the readmission. Had it been noticed that the second claim was a readmission, it might have been better to rebill and collect something on it. The readmission was for the same DRG and only 24 hours after discharge. They have appeal rights, but it's unlikely they're going to overturn this readmission denial. And finally, a colleague shared a story about a peer-to-peer for a case they had no hope of overturning. In fact, when it reached the appeals team, they said it would be a complete waste of time to even try. In this particular case, the failed peer-to-peer and subsequent appeals team analysis simply delayed resubmission of a revised claim and decreased margin on the lower reimbursement. I share these to demonstrate that peer-to-peer discussions should only be done as an integrated component of a global revenue cycle program that includes optimizing correct payments, shortening AR, and the long-term goal of deterring payer predatory behavior. Next, I actually want to address peer-to-peer overturn rates. RevCycle colleagues brag about a high rate of overturn peer-to-peer. That is not a marker for a valuable peer-to-peer program. It's a measure of payer competence. For example, status is a bimodal decision, which in theory should be correct 50% of the time just by flipping a coin. A 100% overturn rate indicates a decision-making technique that is worse than random decisions. And while I'm on peer-to-peer overturn, it's important to remember that you can measure peer-to-peer rates and you can measure peer-to-peer success. I propose that these are inverse metrics. The only reason this would not be the case is if payers offer peer-to-peers only on soft denials, or the payer is shifting to denials that are not subject to peer-to-peer. So what should providers do? Well, first, CFOs should understand the impact of peer-to-peer on finances. Do peer-to-peer overturns really impact ARs? The historic reason for peer-to-peer has been we get our money sooner, but most CFOs do not know that to be true. As we've seen, sometimes a successful, quote, peer-to-peer results in lower payment or just margin erosion. The verbal agreement between the peers is worth the paper it's printed on and may not be subject to the same payment timelines as appeals. Next, we should consider outcomes. In theory, every peer-to-peer overturn would also be overturned on appeal. The difference is that peer-to-peer creates no paper trail or documentation of payer rationale. Every provider should analyze and compare the impact of peer-to-peer and appeals outcomes on AR, correct payment, and margin. Remember, our peer-to-peer is an expensive strategy and should only be deployed strategically. Back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks very much, Dr. Hall. That was our own physician and attorney, Dr. John K. Hall. Dr. Hall reported our lead story. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thanks to our panelists this morning, Matthew Albright, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and of course, Dr. John K. Hall, who reported our lead story. Hey, and one more thing before we go. Please join me tomorrow on Talk 10 Tuesday. That's when you're going to learn how to improve your patient access systems. Until tomorrow, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for RAC Monitor and Monitor Money. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a great week.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of RAC Monitor.